Please keep your Bibles open at that particular reading because we're going to be working our way through some of it. We're looking at that particular passage from verse 19 to verse 31 of chapter 20. And I've entitled my talk for this morning, Believing in Jesus is Both Rational and Personal. When you think about it, the crucifixion of Jesus must have come as a devastating blow to Thomas. All of his hopes and dreams were focused in this man. He'd promised so much. He said that he was the way into eternal life. And then now to suddenly see his lifeless body hanging from that cross must have been absolutely devastating, crushing for Thomas and the other disciples. When I was about 8 or 9, I had this hamster, or hamsters in fact, and the mother hamster actually gave birth to 5 little ones. And they were the joy of my life. I built a little cage for them. I had a sort of sliding door as an entrance for them. I crushed up paper and put it inside, and I had one of those little wheels that they could exercise and fed them every day. You got the picture. I loved my little hamsters. I loved my little hamsters. And then one day, my younger brother, without my permission, opened up the cage to show one of his friends the hamsters. Maybe they were playing with them. I'm not sure exactly what happened, but one of them, the mother, fell on the ground. And the cat, our ginger cat, took hold of this hamster in its mouth. I don't know if you've ever heard that growling that a cat does when it's got a prey in its mouth and you're trying to get it out. Well, I heard this ginger cat growl. And we tried to get the hamster out as quickly as possible, but when we finally did so, the hamster was dead, stone dead. And I remember throwing myself down and pummeling the ground with my fists, bawling as I did so. I was so distraught. And I imagine Thomas must have felt something like that when he saw Jesus dying upon the cross. Jesus had, remember, made these incredible claims. I'm the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except by me. He who has seen me has seen the Father. I and the Father are one. He who believes in me, even though he die, yet shall he live. And along with the other disciples, Thomas had begun to believe in Jesus' words. He understood from Jesus that if he followed Jesus, Jesus would lead him into eternal life. And now here was the supposed life giver hanging lifeless on a cross. And you can almost imagine Thomas pummeling the ground, so distraught. Which may explain why Thomas was so reluctant to accept the testimony of his fellow disciples when they told him that they had seen Jesus, that Jesus had visited them, and that he wasn't dead, but that he was alive. And it was a case, I think, for Thomas of once bitten, twice shy. He didn't want to have his hopes raised so they could be dashed again. And so we find him saying in verse 25, "Unless I see the nail marks in his hands and put my finger where the nails were and put my hands into his side, I will not believe." In other words, I will not believe unless I have hard evidence, unless I can see with my own eyes and touch with my own hands, run my fingers over his scars. The scars, I'm sure you recognize this, are a little bit of a surprise because they're not the sort of thing you expect on a resurrected body. Commentators have discussed this one and have suggested that what you have here is not just scars, but badges of honor. Continual reminders to those who look upon him of the suffering that he had to endure for our sakes. unless I see the nail marks in his hands and put my finger where the nails were and put my hand onto his side, I will not believe. And a week later, there is Jesus suddenly standing before him, hands out, hands raised, saying, come, do it. Reach out your hand. Touch. Feel. Put your finger here. See my hands. Reach out your hand and put it into my side. Stop doubting and believe. Can you imagine how Thomas must have felt at that precise moment? Maybe a little embarrassed that he had refused the testimony of the other disciples. Maybe a little bit ashamed at the outrageous statement he had made. I mean, it was arrogant, rude in the light of something so sacred. But at the same time, he would have been overjoyed, ecstatic that Jesus was not dead, that his Lord was alive, that he had overcome death. And there was no need for him to reach out and touch. He knew that Jesus was alive, that it was Jesus who was standing before him, resurrected from the dead. And he cries out, my Lord and my God. It's like the resurrection for Thomas suddenly confirms everything that he was suspecting or believing beforehand. He'd always thought that Jesus was more than just a man, that he was, in fact, God come down. And the resurrection, in a real sense, confirmed that. Because who else but God could turn back the processes of biology? Who else but God could overcome death? My Lord and my God. You have to ask the question, is it possible that Thomas overstated the case? That in his excitement, in his joy, he took it a step too far in ascribing deity to Jesus? Was he wrong to address Jesus not only as his Lord, but as his God? Well, it's interesting. It's significant, I think, that there is not a hint of rebuke in Jesus' response. It's not like Jesus is saying, no, Thomas, I think you've overdone it a bit. Whilst I admire your passion, to refer to me as your God is really not appropriate. There's none of that in Jesus' response, none at all. Instead, Jesus praises Thomas for his declaration. And he confirms that those who believe similarly will be blessed. And so the only conclusion you can draw is that it was right and it is right and proper for Thomas to acknowledge Jesus, not only as his Lord, but also as his God. There is, however, something really baffling about Jesus' response in verse 29. Have a look at verse 29. Because you have seen me, you have believed. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed. It's baffling because it seems that Jesus is suggesting that Thomas was in some sense wrong. It's like he's scolding Thomas, that Thomas needed more evidence. Thomas, you needed hard facts. It was only when you saw me with your own eyes that you believed. How much better it would have been if you could have believed without the evidence, without seeing. And there are many people who view Christianity through that prism. On the one hand, you have those people, the thinking people, the people who are rational, people who are science-based, and they can't bring themselves to believe. But then on the other hand, you have the shallow, the simple-minded, the non-thinking, the gullible religious types who are not concerned about evidence, but who just take this great big leap into the darkness. People who believe because they've got some deep-seated need. A crutch is what they require. And so they believe for that reason. But those who are scientifically minded cannot go there. I'm sure you've heard this sort of comment that people make when they hear that somebody is a Christian. They say, "Oh, good on you for believing. That is so nice. I hope it makes you happy. But my commitment to science won't allow me to go there." And maybe there are one or two folk here this morning who think similarly. It's okay for your wife to believe, because she is that sort of way inclined. But you're far too logical for that sort of thing. These poor deluded Christians, fortunately for us, we know better. One of the mistakes that people often make when they try and understand the Bible is that they take verses out of context. They read them in isolation. The other day, I was confronted by an intruder. And he was wearing a mask and he was waving a gun in my direction. "Hand over your wallet," he demanded. "And along with your wallet, all of your other valuables." Really scary. But did I mention that it was a toy gun? And did I mention that it was a game that was being played? The context, you see, is all important. And the mistake that we've made with verse 29 is that we try to read it in isolation from its context. The next two verses make it plain. Have a look with me at the verses that follow. "Jesus did many other miraculous signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book, but these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name." And so what John, the author of this gospel and the close friend of Jesus, is in fact saying is that he has included this interaction with Thomas and all of the other stories along with it so that people might have sufficient evidence, so that his readers will be blessed in that we will all have the evidence we need to make an informed decision. And that, I think, is what Jesus is saying in verse 29, that Thomas indeed was privileged to have first-hand evidence, to see it with his own eyes. But what about those who weren't there? What about those who did not have that privilege, who did not see, who did not have that first-hand experience, who did not have the opportunity to run their fingers over his scars? What about them? Well, they will be blessed through the testimony of people like Thomas, the story we've just read, and people like Peter and John and Mary and Paul, and many other men and women who were witnesses to the resurrection. So when Thomas cries, "My Lord and my God," this was not a blind leap in the dark. This was not something he did without thinking. This was not a case of, "God, catch me if you're out there, and let's hope that you are." No, it was a rational, it was a reasonable decision based on the incontrovertible evidence that was before him. Now, one of the objections that some people raise is, "Yeah, that's all very fine for Thomas, but for me, I've got to rely on secondhand evidence because we weren't there." But you need to remember that actually that is what we normally do. We normally base our decisions on second-hand evidence. For example, it's hardly ever the case that when there's a murder that takes place, there's actually a camera crew there sort of photographing or taking pictures of everything that happens. No, the judge and the jury have to make a decision based on the evidence of witnesses who were there, even though they weren't there themselves. And it's no different with Jesus. We're being asked to make a decision based on the testimony of those who were present and on the available evidence. Are you aware, for example, that the establishment tried to cover up what had actually happened on Easter Sunday? They knew that Jesus was talking about coming back, and they suspected that the disciples might try something, so they actually put guards at the entrance to the tomb. So what happened to the guards? All that the authorities had to do to quash this rumor that Jesus had risen from the dead, all they had to do was actually produce the body. It was a case of, hey guys, if you believe that Jesus has risen from the dead, how come we have his body? Here it is. But they were never able to do that. Are you aware that over 500 people witnessed the resurrection of Jesus? The physical resurrection. He appears to Mary at the tomb. He appeared to the disciples as a group on at least four separate occasions. He appeared to two of them on the road to Emmaus. He appeared, we're told, on one occasion to more than 500 at one time. He appeared to James, his brother. Quite something to convince your own brother that you've risen from the dead. Now, obviously, the caliber of the witnesses is really important. We often hear about witnesses whose testimony is discredited. But the one thing we know about these witnesses is that they value truth above everything else. And further to the point, they were prepared to die for what they had seen. You find Peter, for example, standing before the authorities, and they are threatening him with violence if he carries on talking about the risen Christ. And his answer is profound. Do with us as you will. But as for us, we cannot help speaking about what we have both seen and heard. They were reliable. They were trustworthy witnesses. And their evidence is something you can rely upon. William Taylor quotes a particular judge, highly respected High Court judge in the UK, Sir Jeremy Cook. And this is what he says. You can't dismiss the gospel accounts because of your preconceptions that dead men don't rise, or that there is nothing beyond the material, or that they are just fabricated. Examine the evidence. Don't close your mind. Start from the empty tomb. Many have been persuaded, including two Lord Justices and one Lord Chancellor. The problem in the end is not with the evidence. The issue is whether we are prepared to follow the evidence where it leads. So you're not being asked to jettison your brain when you believe in Jesus. No, you're being asked to make a rational, logical decision based on evidence. And that is what Thomas is doing here. My Lord and my God, based on the evidence, is his cry. So let me ask you, are you open to the possibility that Jesus rose from the dead? Because there are some people who are so wedded to their atheism, who are so wedded to their worldview of a closed world without any interference from outside, that they won't even allow for the possibility. They discount it out of hand. From their perspective, it is just not possible for the laws of biology to be reversed. Dead people just don't come back to life. Is that where you are at? Or do you concede that the creator of the universe, the one who made the whole world, does have the power to intervene in the world that he has made? And that on occasions, that he is able to do so. And that is exactly what he's done here. Isn't that what the evidence suggests? So, believing in Jesus is rational, but it's also personal. Notice Thomas's response when he says, "My Lord, my God," verse 28. It's more than just a declaration. I know that you are the Lord. I know that you are God. It's much more than that, isn't it? It's deeply personal. It's in fact a little bit like, I don't know if you've ever, well, I'm sure you have seen those movies when the king in olden days suddenly enters the room and everyone in the room suddenly bows down, yields, as it were, to the king. And there is something of that in what Thomas is doing here as he bows, as it were, in his heart and yields to Jesus, his Lord and his God. And that was for me the breakthrough that made things clear for me when I recognized that I needed to yield to Jesus, to submit to his rule in my own life. I knew that he was who he claimed to be. I believed all of the evidence. I knew it was true. But I hadn't yet come to the stage where I was able to say that he is my Lord. He is my God. And when I was able to do that, everything changed for me. Earlier on in the gospel, John does actually say this. He says that Jesus came to that which was his own. He came to his own people, and by and large, his own people did not receive him. But then he says this, yet to all who did receive him, to those who believed in his name, he gave the right to become the children of God. When we receive Jesus, when we open our hearts to him, a miracle takes place. And we find ourselves translated from this one world into the world that is his world. We suddenly find ourselves born into God's family. So in summary, believing in Jesus is entirely rational, but it's also deeply personal. And in a moment, we're going to be celebrating communion together. And communion, among other things, is an opportunity, particularly as you receive the bread, as you consume it, and as you drink the wine. Communion is an opportunity for you to affirm again that Jesus is your Lord and your God. To, as it were, take him again as your Lord. To receive him again as the one who you are in submission to. And so I encourage you to do that. If you've never done that before, then why don't you use this day and this meal as an opportunity to do just that. Would those who are going to assist me at the table please come forward?